Hey, Empowered listeners. Welcome. Today we have a very special guest. In this episode, we talk cardiac health, hypertension management guidelines, all from a cardiology nurse practitioner perspective. We hope you enjoy this episode as much as we enjoyed collaborating with her.
Welcome to Empowered.
Hey, I'm Dr. Nancy Baker, certified adult nurse practitioner.
Hola, I'm Margarita Marmolejo, certified family nurse practitioner.
This is a podcast where we
chat about everyday health topics supported by evidence-based research
that you can relate to in a fun, unfiltered environment. All right. Hey, everybody. We're back on Empowered. Today, we got a wonderful guest here. Her name is Trenise Goodlow. Welcome, Trenise.
Hey there. How are you guys doing?
Good, good, good. So everybody, this is a Dr. G, the NP, and we're going to talk a little bit today about hypertension, heart disease, how it affects our community, particularly our minority community and the underserved. So we're real excited to have her today.
Yes, welcome. We're so happy to have you, Dr. G.
Thank you. And I've told you guys this before. I feel like I'm in the presence of celebrities and greatness. So it is truly an honor to be here with both of you.
Thank you so much.
Oh,
welcome. Before we get into the formality stuff, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, passion.
Oh, gosh. So let's see. I finished undergrad nursing back in 2010, went to the Southern University in Baton Rouge. We're known for our band. Shout out to SU's band.
All right,
the metal bands over Grambling all the time. Anybody from Grambling listening? I started out as a med-surg nurse. And it's interesting because I was, like I said, a med-surg nurse working nights, as all of us have probably done. And there's a teletech. And I would always stand behind her looking at the EKGs. And then she's like, do you want to know how to read EKGs? And I'm like, yeah. And she goes, most nurses can't read EKGs. And I was like, what? So that got me, the basketball player in me. I'm very, ball players are competitive. So I'm like, I'm going to be able to do that. So I would read the strips on the floor every night at 4 a.m.
Oh, wow.
And that's how she kind of got me started. Fast forward to my last job on the floor. I used to work in 24-hour OBS, and we had a lady, and she, we were getting a report, and the night nurse told me, she's like, yeah, she's a normal sinus rhythm. Well, I glanced up at the EKG, those strips
monitor.
And to me, it looked like a first degree and a bundle branch to me. Mm-hmm. So I walked in a room and I was like, hi, I'm Trenise, I'm your nurse. Are you feeling okay? What's going on? She was so sweet. She's like, you're busy. Nurses are busy. Don't worry about little old me. Just come back when you have time. I was like, I got that feeling. Y'all know that feeling.
Oh, yeah.
So I asked my tech. I was like, hey, can you go get some vitals? She got me some vitals. I'm pulling up her 12 lead. 12 lead looks like beautiful normal sinus rhythm. I'm like, that doesn't look like what I look at the monitor. Called in, and of course I assessed the patient. I said, are you feeling okay? Chest pain. She's like, no, I'm fine. I'm good. Bye. Like, very sweet. But she's like, bye. Called internal medicine, told him about it. He was like, I don't know. Why don't you call cardiology? Cool. Called cardiology. And he was like, go ahead and get a 12 lead EKG now. I said, okay. We got a 12 lead EKG. And sure enough, it's still like a first degree in the bundle branch. And he's like, I'm going to come up and see her. Cool. So he was in room with her. So I'm, of course, rounding on other patients, just doing my thing. I happened to come out the room and he himself is physically wheeling her out of the room, like rushing off. I actually never saw the lady ever again.
Oh my.
So a week or two later, I ran into him and I was like, hey, remember that lady, the situation? He had to think for a second. He was like, oh yeah. She had a small heart attack. Good catch. He just walked away.
Wow. Imagine if you did not recognize,
Yeah.
That change in the patient's leads and EKG.
Well, and it was, the funny thing was my nurse manager, she was in my ear. She was like, you need to go back to school. You need to go back to school. At the time I was a newlywed, I was trying to live a different type of situation. I wasn't into that, right. But I was precepting and I really enjoyed precepting. And I was charged nurse some time as well. Okay. So after that, that kind of was a sign to me that I should continue. So I enrolled at the University of Arizona. I did a BSN to DNP program with a specialty as an acute care nurse practitioner. And so my interest has always been like EKG strips, cardiac, hypertension. Fast forward to graduation, of course, we have to do our dissertation, our DNP project. I chose hypertension in the African-American community. So I looked at JNCA guidelines 7 and 8, which I feel like are outdated now because that was 2014. And now I'm talking about ACC that was in 2017. Mm-hmm. But anyway, just how African-Americans should, first line for them should be thiazides or calcium channel blockers. Whereas with the non-African-American population is ACEs and ARBs, at least back then. Of course, we know that's changed now. And so my award, well, I won an award at graduation for most outstanding dissertation in a vulnerable population. So I'm very proud of that.
Fantastic.
Then I graduated and, you know, it's rough times out here when you're in a saturated market such as Dallas. I only had two job offers. The first job is the one that I'm at currently as a cardiology nurse practitioner. The second job I got, it was hospital medicine, which was my second choice. What scared me away from that job was a couple of things. One, it was 4 hours from my house, but really, it was a night job, which I was okay with. You know, you got to pay your dues. I get that, but I would have been the only provider in a rural setting.
Terrifying.
And you guys, y'all are ICU nurses, and I'm a typical med-surg nurse that thinks there's magic behind the doors. Oh. And you know what I'm talking about, though.
Yeah.
And so when the CMO was like, yeah, you know, if you want this, I'll give it to you. But if you don't feel safe, don't take this.
Mm.
Didn't take it to cardiology, which was my first
choice. Anyway.
I wanted to do that anyway.
Yeah.
Right. And here I am now, and I'm still at that job and I enjoy it very much. And I have great relationships with the patients and it's fantastic.
Wow. That's amazing. And first of all, way to listen to your gut, like all going all the way back. I think we ignore that feeling a lot, thinking that we don't know enough or, you know, we're wrong. But that feeling, that gut feeling that you had and we all, I think, have had at one point or another is so important to listen to, at least investigate. So well done.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course. And I, you know, and I used to precept the new grads on the floor. And then right now I work as an adjunct faculty in an FNP program. So I tell my students all the time, like, it's there for a reason. Like, I'd rather you follow it and it'd be nothing, because I've had the gut feeling I've been wrong, mm-hmm. you know,
oh, yeah.
But your job is to be a patient advocate and protect people.
Right.
So I'd rather be wrong and be like, you know, sorry, my bad,
yeah.
than ignore it and be like, oh, I wish. So,
yeah, absolutely. Especially when it involves people's lives, you know. You got to be very, very careful. You got to be conscientious about the patient. And I think that's what makes nurse practitioners good at what we do, because we have that nursing bedside experience. We have that gut feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, like, majority of us are women, we always have that gut feeling that we wish in. And, you know, and I think that plays in our favor, definitely.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
It's a great profession to be a part of. We've been the most trusted profession. If you go back to even 2001, and we didn't get it in 2001 because of, you know, 9/11, and rightfully so, firefighters and police, you know, deserve that.
Yeah.
But if you go back, we've always been most trusted.
You're absolutely right.
So we are going to kind of start diving in and talk about cardiac health in the minority population, specifically African-Americans, Hispanics. So, you know, of course, majority of African-Americans have, and Hispanics have health disparities. And so how do you see that playing a role or lack thereof in your setting when you take care of your patients?
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because being African-American myself, and then being female myself, being a part of a double minority, most things aren't geared to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly why I did my doctoral dissertation on a vulnerable population, because it needs to be highlighted. And vulnerable populations deserve equal health as far as anyone else does.
Right.
It's a problem in this country, but you can't fix the problem if you're not willing to work, right?
Or even recognize it.
Right, exactly. So it's near and dear to my heart. It's kind of interesting because I really can't say why I'm interested in hypertension or cardiac. I just am. It was just a natural thing that kind of happened for me. Mm-hmm. As far as the hypertension, I was very interested and invested because in my research, I found that the medicine most people reach for is a beta blocker to control hypertension. And that's like fourth or fifth line.
Yeah. First, second or third.
Yeah. Well, if you go back to 2014 with the JNC8 guidelines that I did my research on, it's non-African Americans and ASTEN R. Now, the only caveat to that was if it was an African American with diabetes, then you do an ACE or ARB to protect the kidneys. If they didn't have diabetes, you did the thiazide or the calcium channel blocker. Fast forward to most current, I won't say now, but I'll just say most current, ACC, American College of Cardiology, published in 2017, that first line for everyone is thiazides. And that's interesting to me. It went from being specific to African Americans, and now it's really for everybody.
Why is that interesting?
Yeah, I find it highly interesting because we're more alike than we are different.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at it from a second line perspective with the hypertension, if the person is African American, the next thing I'm going to reach for is a calcium channel blocker. Mm-hmm. ACEs and ARBs are not really as effective in that population. It's interesting with the Hispanic population, though, there isn't really, it seems like it's just an African American thing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like a separate entity.
Which it's unfortunate because, and we're getting a little into ethnicity and stuff, but you know, there are a lot of Afro-Latinas. I mean, if you have someone from Puerto Rico, I'm also, you know, I have African in me. So it's like, you know, and then forget, you know, Colombia, right?
Maria,
I mean, it's a wide variety of people.
Yeah. So we have a very large Afro Hispanic community and indigenous Hispanic community indigenous Latin community. So we have a good mix.
Right.
So, and really I don't think they should be like excluded. I think, like you said, we're all the same, you know, now we are, everybody is mixed.
Right.
Cross paths, you know, so definitely. But go ahead.
It's interesting that you guys bring that up because I find that a lot of people assume, right? Like a lot of people, you don't even ask. You look at someone and you say, oh, well, she's probably this or he's probably that. And you don't even get into that conversation. Some people find it uncomfortable, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, I always tell people when you look at lab, right? If you look at the GFR, it'll say GFR and it'll say GFR black. Mm-hmm. It matters. And it's really not about, oh, I'm racist or, oh, I'm trying to exclude. No, you actually need to know that information for care. Just like we know in the African-American population and Hispanic population, diabetes is quite prevalent.
Very prevalent.
So you can have a Hispanic that may look Caucasian. So you're like, oh, he looks Caucasian. So I'm not going to ask. Right. It's funny. I had a patient. He's so funny. He goes, you know, I look white until I open my mouth. and he has a very heavy, thick Hispanic accent because he's from Cuba. Mm-hmm. So it's just interesting. I think it makes the asker more uncomfortable than the person themselves because the person themselves knows what they are.
Yeah.
You know,
and they expect somebody to either, you know, not understand or not know. And I'm sure they expect a question at some point. I know I do all the time, especially after I open my mouth. I look very Hispanic, but then I open my mouth. They're like, oh, I didn't expect this from you. Well, so it's very interesting. Well, our expectations as providers, you know, I think there's a point of discomfort, like you mentioned, but it is for our own knowledge to know that about the patient and how we can provide better care. And if we never ask those questions, we are missing a big chunk of that big picture that we could use to help the patient.
Absolutely. It's interesting that I tell my students this all the time. I do a case study. I'll do a cholesterol case study or a hypertension case study, which I love doing case studies. And everything I do or say is really rooted in evidence-based practice and guidelines to give people best outcomes. It's very important we do that. However, I always stress to my students that evidence-based practice does not supersede clinical judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because a lot of times they'll say, well, the guidelines said this and the guidelines say that. Yes, I understand that, but you have a living, breathing person in front of you and you know details that the guidelines do not know. So guidelines guide, right? You don't have to be so stringent with it, but it's a point of reference. So you know outcome data. If I do this, I can expect this, but this is a little different. So we have to shift our approach with this person.
You have to individualize care,
basically. Yeah. 100%.
100%.
Well, the hypertension, it's funny because I do something that's very basic and I actually see a lot of providers don't do it. And I got this practice really from the American Heart Association and one of the cardiologists I work with. I ask people to keep blood pressure logs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know some providers that do that, mm-hmm. but I see the piece that they miss is they don't check the machine.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I see it all the time. I kid you not. I had a guy in office the other day. The machine was 40 points off. And I tell patients that all the time. I said, I need the machine.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine me making decisions off 40 points off? That's dangerous.
It is. You're right. And I'm glad you bring that up because I do tell my patients, if you do have a machine at home, and a lot of them don't know how to use it properly. That's another piece is mm-hmm. how they're sitting, how they position their arms, how they're... So it's not just a QC of the machine, but it's a QC of the patient and their position and posture. So I do ask them to bring... I do ask them to bring the log, but the machine itself so that we can compare it with ours or the manual at least one time
right.
to make, you know, to do that QC, that quality check on it, make sure that it is functioning properly. That's a really interesting point.
Well, I've made it the practice. Maybe I'm a little anal because I like my hypertension. I got to make sure all my stuff is the way I want it. I actually went on AHA's website. And if you go on there, there's a little man. It shows like the five steps of taking blood pressure, like sit for 5 to 10 minutes, keep your arm this way, uncross your legs, that. I will staple that to the blood pressure log so they have it with them. So my MAs have like a stack of them. So they just know, oh, Goodloe, she wants a check. So go ahead and give them this. Like it's already a wrap.
That's an excellent point.
It's very important to me that if you're going to do it, I want to do it right. And per AHA, to diagnose hypertension, you have to have two separate readings on two separate days. Now, having said that, I tell my students all the time, if I have somebody's blood pressure is like 160 or 170 and I check in again and I get the same thing, will I start them on medicine? Yeah, I probably will.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I might say elevated blood pressure rather than true hypertension. But again, it's a case by case situation. Nothing is always.
Sure.
Very true. Very true.
Speaking of hypertension, I will mention this. How the guidelines have changed. We have it drilled in our heads that 120 over 80. I mean, if you ask anybody, oh, it's 120, it's around 120 over 80, you're good. The guidelines state under 120 and under 80 is ideal for adults. And the newer guidelines say 120 to 129 over 80 is pre-hypertensive. Mm-hmm. And 130 over 80 is now hypertension. The American Heart says it. American College of Cardiology says it, and the American Diabetic Association says that we should treat over 130 over 80. I tell that to every single patient, whether they're diabetic or not. The reason why is because it really doesn't matter. We all should really follow a diabetic diet.
Right.
So that's three governing bodies that are saying we should be treating over 130 over 80. Now, if I have somebody that's 99 years old,
maybe not.
Right.
We'll individualize that again.
Right. Exactly. So sometimes I know students struggle. I know us as providers, we do a better job of it because we see such an array of patients in front of us. But my students really struggle with that. And I always tell them, you know, nothing is always, and you have to be able to justify every action you do. If somebody asks you, well, why did you do this and not that? If you can explain why you did what you did, it's probably right. And if you can't, just say, well, just because the guideline said, well, no, that's not the right answer.
Yeah, each individual person has their individual situations and requirements.
Right, of course. So that's kind of my approach. I'm a bit aggressive about it. The younger the patient is, the more aggressive I am about managing it. And obviously, if you have someone that's super elderly, I'll take 140 over 80. We're good. Like, you're, you know, we're not going to be, you know, we're not going to be doing all of that. So it, patient history, presentation, I mean, it all matters.
So I'm going to, you know, I'm going to pull in a zebra here. You know, we've had some patients at the clinic, African-Americans, you know, on HTCZ, maybe ACE-ARB, amlodipine, and they probably threw in like either spironolactone or some other agent.
Or a beta blocker somewhere.
Beta blocker mm-hmm. somewhere. And they are on five agents. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I used to work with a nephrologist that would say, if they are on more than three agents and you're still getting blood pressures over 150, 160, mm-hmm. 70, and you've done a renal ultrasound to make sure they're not dealing with renal artery stenosis, at that point, you got to question some compliance. You know, are they truly taking the medication? How often do you find that the case is compliance when you have those types of situations?
Let me quote some more data. You guys will see I'm all about quoting data. There's been some, when I was doing my research, there was a couple studies that said only medicine compliance is about 50%. Mm-hmm. The way I approach medicines is, if you tell me you're taking it, I'm going to believe you. Now, is that always accurate? Probably not, because people lie, and I understand that. But as providers, we only can deal with the information we have, right? Sure. So I can't say, well, I think he's lying, so I'm going to add two ACE inhibitors because he's not taking the one. So if I make another one, I don't play that game. Like, if you tell me you're taking it, you're taking it. May not be true, but that's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. The current guidelines state that if you're on more than three antihypertensives and still having issues, you should look up a secondary cause. The guidelines also state the most common cause of secondary hypertension, which now we're getting into the nitty gritty, and I love this. this is what excites me.
Devil's in the details.
Let me backtrack before I start talking about secondary hypertension. So primary hypertension is present in 90% of people who have hypertension. So a lot of times, well, not a lot of times, that's why when we have high blood pressure, we go ahead and slap some meds on, because it's primary. It's not a cause. We just do. Now, of course, we know genetics plays a role. Lifestyle plays a role, of course, but they just have it. Once you hit three, you got to ask yourself, are they really having primary or is it secondary? Mm-hmm. Right? You mentioned renal artery stenosis, and that's great. What if they have an adrenal tumor? Mm-hmm. So we do more than really just the renal ultrasound. Obviously, you want to check for renal artery stenosis, but we'll get renin and aldosterone, and we'll get plasma metanephrines as well. I know some primary care providers feel comfortable doing that. Others don't. If you look at the guidelines say refer to cardiology if you got three and you can't. Yeah. You know, you just move on. But we're doing those sort of things. We'll even get cortisol levels as well to see if that's an issue with them having it. But you make a valid point. If they're not taking it, I kind of just take the same approach. You're going to be seeing me kind of often. I'm going to be seeing you every couple of weeks or so. We're going to be titrating, and I am quite aggressive in my approach with hypertension, but I'm also, well, let me backtrack. I'm conservatively aggressive, meaning I'm conservative in the fact that I'm going to start you on low dose and go slow, but I'm aggressive about wanting particular benchmarks for you.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, I tell patients, I hate medicine. I know I'm sitting here talking about medicine, but we have to talk about medicine because, let's be real, most people will not do what it takes to do lifestyle modification.
Oh, right, true story. I mean, oh,
let's be real. I mean, are you gonna get 10,000 steps a day? Are you gonna walk 30 minutes a day at least per American Heart Association? Are you gonna limit your alcohol? Are you gonna stop smoking? Are you gonna have a healthy body mass index? I mean, all of these things matter. I had a guy tell me in clinic point blank, this is cholesterol, but I mean, we're talking about basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. Managing his cholesterol. I said, look, you know, I want you to kind of watch your triglycerides. I want you to cut out the fats, the sugar, not cut it out, but reduce, try to work on that. Mm-hmm. Or I could give you a pill. He's like, just give me the pill. Like, he was not interested. He's like, just, I'm here for you to give me a pill. Just give me a pill. And as someone who doesn't like medicine, it goes against, like,
your core.
Right? I'm like, I don't want to give you a pill.
All your core sensibility.
Right. I'm like, you're killing me. But as providers, that's what makes us, we have to mold to our patients, right? Like, mm-hmm. you evaluate who will do what and who feels comfortable with what. There's another phenomenon, since I'm talking about providers. I wrote about it again in my research. It's called clinical inertia. Clinical inertia was first described, I would be misquoting the person, so I'm not going to say the name I think it is, but he first described it back in 2001. So basically what it means is new clinical data or outcome data or whatever will come out, and providers won't shift with that.
Okay, yeah.
And a lot of times it's because, well, this is the way we've always done it, or I've gotten good results before, so I'm not going to change what I'm doing now. I think that you're doing people a disservice by not evolving.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, but some providers are stuck in clinical inertia, and hypertension specifically is one of the leading disease processes where you see clinical inertia.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Yeah, I guess I can see that. I had a conversation with one of my peers not too long ago about that. And, you know, he basically said, like, oh, I'm used to doing X, Y, and Z regimen, almost like in this algorithm for my patients. And we talked about, like, new providers, new residents, new nurses, new nurse practitioners, that they come in with that new knowledge. And that's really good because it kind of spices things up.
Right, right.
And it tries to get you out of that
comfort
pattern.
Zone. Well, it's a comfort zone, you know?
Yeah, it is.
Like what you hear?
Subscribe to Empowered.
Now available on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and many other platforms.
Subscribing alerts you when new episodes become available.
Also, like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram.
So I work with three different cardiologists. One of them I share an office with. He has basically taken me under his wing, rightfully so, mostly probably out of proximity, right? He's taking me under his wing, and he tuned me into something called practical reviews, mm-hmm. and practical reviews for cardiology. I'm pretty sure there's practical reviews for other, you know, specialties and whatnot. He's also clued me in on some stuff to stay up to date, so much so that company at first that I worked for really didn't want to pay for it because they were like, oh, you're an MP. Mm-hmm. And he lobbied for me. He was like, this is some good information for her to know. And so now they're paying for me to get these things.
Oh, good.
It's funny. So I'll tell a story real quick. This happened about 3 weeks ago or so. Had a patient, and I am a perfectionist. And I can say that about myself. And when I say I'm a perfectionist, I don't mean it as a compliment. Like, I mean, like, I need to work on that. So I had this patient. And I was like, oh, his potassium level high. I don't like that. He's on spironolactone. I know he has cardiomyopathy, and cardiomyopathy patients need spironolactone because it's a cardiovascular benefit for best outcomes to be on it. But if someone's potassium level's high, we are thinking about this, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I knew the potassium level, it had been drawn a few months ago, and we didn't have any other lab. And to complicate it, I was trying to up titrate him on Entresto. And anybody who knows Entresto, that can cause potassium to be high. So I'm like, crap. The Entresto's top dog. And I got to get him up. And we think it may be high or not. So I actually told him to stop taking the spironolactone because I was trying to get his Entresto up. I was going to recheck. And if I could, I was going to slide it back in. The spironolactone, mm-hmm. I mean, I was going to slide that bad boy back in. And so I was really hard on myself. And I was like, oh, I think I screwed up. So the cardiologist at our office, he's like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, oh, I think I messed up. He's like, what'd you do? And I told him, he's like, that's it? I said, yeah. I said, when are you getting lab? I said, oh, I told him to go get lab like now. He's like, okay. see what his potassium is doing now. And if it's high, you will have to leave him off for a second. If it's good, go ahead and restart it. He's like, I thought you messed up.
That was perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have gotten rid of the spironolactone without getting the lab first. But he's like, I see what you did. I see what you were thinking, because you were thinking about the entrectome and you were worried about that. Mm-hmm. He looked at me. He was like, you're good. He's like, you need to stop. Like, I promise you're good. And this guy, like, all joking aside, he is, what's a good adjective to describe him? He's a complicated gentleman. He's very on it, which doesn't bother me because I have that personality too. So we're going to be on it together. But he's shown me some compassion at some unexpected times. Like, I remember I had an EKG sitting in front of me and I was struggling. I was like, is this an LAFB? Is this an LAFB? I don't know if this is an LAFB. So I said, hey, can you tell me if this is an LAFB? And for people who don't know what an LAFB is, it's a left anterior fascicular block. So basically you have three main wires in the bottom part of the heart, one on the right, two on the left. Two on the left, there's one in the front and one in the back. So I was questioning if the wire in the front bottom left had slow electricity, because if that could continue, it could lead to a left bundle branch block. Anyway, so I'm looking at the EKG and I'm like, oh, I don't know. So I was like, hey, can you tell me if this is an LAFB? And he kind of looks at me and smiles. And I'm like, why are you smiling at me? Just tell me if it's an LAFB. I'm unsure. He's like, I'm just curious of how many nurse practitioners know what an LAFB is.
No, and I said, honestly, a few.
I said, honestly, primary care. I was like, I learned it from you.
All right. So real quick, because we're going to wrap it up pretty soon, but you know, both Nitsa and I, we do primary care. So from a cardiology standpoint, coming back to the clinical end of it, what are your like top three things that you would recommend to primary care nurse practitioners, whether adult or family, when it comes to, you know, any kind of cardiac issue, whether it's hypertension or any other cardiac issue, what would you recommend? What would your top three things be a guidance for us primary care folks?
Your tidbits.
Yeah.
Okay. Your secrets, your deep, dark secrets.
Number one, let me talk about cholesterol for a second.
Oh.
I see a lot of primary care. The current guidelines state if a person has coronary artery disease or diabetes, and half these people have both, let's be real. Mm. Okay. The goal LDL is 69.
Oh, okay. Huh.
It's not under 100. It's 69. Mm. So I get a lot of times that patients will tell, well, I just saw my primary care and they said that my cholesterols are fine. And I'm like, yeah, you have a bypass, right? Well, I don't like that your LDL is 90. I'm going to fix that.
Let's fix this sooner than later.
So what's interesting to me is sometimes, and hands down, I got to give praise and shout out to family practice. 80% of nurse practitioners are family practice. Mm-hmm. It is overwhelming. I have mad respect. No, for real. I have mad respect because, like, yeah, I get to stay in my bubble. And I have patient, like, I had a patient tell me today, she's like, yeah, I'm having some alopecia. I was like, none of these cardiac meds are doing it, so I'm going to need you to go see that primary care. I said, you might need an endocrinologist consult, but that's not me. So you guys have to have such a large breadth of knowledge that it is truly overwhelming. So I don't fault primary cares when, you know, I see things like that, because you guys have other things. Like, I can't tell you anything about antibiotics. The closest I'm going to get to antibiotics is if somebody is having mitral stenosis and we got to give prophylactic stuff because they're around kids, you know, like that's not, you know, I don't do that, you know. And I find that the biggest thing is we have to respect each other's talents, respect each other's specialties,
yeah,
and not step on toes. But that's one thing I will say on the cholesterol tip. I see a lot of cholesterols that are, I call them borderline. Mm-hmm. Meaning, yeah, it's under 100, which is great, But if you've had three heart attacks and a stroke and your LDL's still 90, I mean, I'm getting a little...
It needs to be better.
Right. Right. I'm getting excited just thinking about it. So I would say that. The LDL. With the blood pressure tip, oh gosh. If I could say one thing, this is what I tell my students all the time about blood pressure in primary care. Stay in your lane. When I say that, I mean your three meds that you want to do is your thiazide, your ACE or ARB. Please don't do ACE and ARB. Your ACE or ARB, and then calcium channel blocker. That's where you live. And if you got to go outside that, you probably need a secondary workup or something. Now, the caveat with that is people with kidney dysfunction.
Mm.
So if you have kidney dysfunction, I might be able not be able to do ACE or ARB or even a diuretic. But then I'm like, okay, if I want to do a beta blocker, okay, beta blockers can slow down AV nodal conduction. Mm-hmm. What's their pulse? Okay. And do you know the difference between a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker and a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker? Because if you give them a non-dihydropyridine, that's going to slow down the AV nodal conduction.
Yep.
So that's what I would say. Live there when you're doing blood pressure. Thiazide, calcium channel block, dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. Let me be specific in that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, your ACE or your ARB. The third thing I would say in primary care is don't be scared of EKGs.
Hmm.
I've spoken to many primary care providers that get nervous and they're like, oh my God, I have to get an EKG.
Wow, that's they terrify me for sure.
Well, it was interesting. I had a lady complaining of shortness of breath. Saw her PCP twice. Gave her antibiotics and I don't know, something. She's still feeling bad. She's like, let me go see cardiology. She did have a history of diastolic heart failure.
Mm.
So she was like, well, maybe it's my heart failure acting up. Let me go see. We do an EKG. The MA hands it to me. I'm like, I know what's wrong with you. You're an AFib. It was easy for me. Luckily, she was already on a anticoagulation.
Mm-hmm.
Because her CHADS VAD score was well over. Well, it's funny. The guidelines say put them on anticoagulation if you're two or more in a man or three or more in a woman. That's new. It used to be two for everybody.
Hmm.
And now aspirin doesn't do anything. That's the newest guidelines. So knowing those things, because if she wasn't on anticoagulation with a high CHADS score, she has a 5-time risk of having a stroke compared to someone who didn't have her problem.
Yeah.
Mm. And then knowing how to dose anticoagulation.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely a cardiology referral. 100%. But, I'm going to pretend.
But if the EKG had been done, I mean, I'm not saying you would have said, you would have knew off bat that it was AFib, but you know it's not sinus.
And you know,
right? Like, wrong. You're like, this
is something quickly.
Right.
Quicker than
this
usual.
This is jacked. She needs to go.
Yeah, you don't ignore it. Absolutely. And it's not, it's, like you said before, it's not knowing about necessarily what's the right or exact treatment. It's knowing what's wrong and knowing what to do with that.
Right. Or who to talk to.
Yeah. Absolutely. Oh my goodness. Well, thank you for that.
Yes.
Because I'm going to go back this next week and and put a little thought into my patients, a different thought, you know, and then that's
a different thought. Yeah,
you're constantly learning, and I've only been out of school for a year and a half. I don't even know, it's been almost 2 years now.
Well, you know, I feel like a baby nurse too. I mean,
brand new.
I graduated grad school in 17, but I was working as a nurse educator, and I kind of kept that job a little bit because I was looking and I wasn't going to just hop at anything. Mm-hmm. So I got my job at the end of 18. Oh. October of 18. And then I was there a little bit, and my husband, we had a fun surprise, ended up having another child. He's our third child. And so I was off for 3 months, and I wasn't even an MP for a year. So when you consider that, I've been an MP for about 2.5 years, maybe two, and just over 2 years. It's something like that. But the growth is crazy because I'm hungry. I'm hungry and I will eat.
Well, that's really good. And I think that's another point. Like you have to want to learn more. You have to want to understand that you don't know everything and seek that knowledge out and learn, constantly learn.
Well, another quote I told the MP I was tutoring yesterday about EKGs, I said, look, how do you expect to shine when you don't want to get rubbed?
Right. That's true. That is very true.
So you better get ready because it's coming.
Yes. You know, before we kind of end this episode, I want to actually talk to you about your upcoming launch on your new endeavors there, Dr. G.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
Why don't you share a little bit about what you got coming up?
Brief overview. Well,
we are super excited. And I say we because I have to give a shout out to my husband because it's not possible without him. He does so much behind the scenes for myself and our boys. So definitely shout out to him. So I'm launching a new business. It's called Dr. G the MP. And I'm focusing on lecturing nurses and nurse practitioners on topics that we may not have gotten enough out of school. Mm. The nurse side of things is more like mentorship, helping you with career development, tips and tricks that I did on the floor that made my life easier. The MP side, I'm lecturing. I'm lecturing about hypertension. I'm lecturing about cholesterols. I'm doing EKGs. I'm doing interesting case studies. I'm in the midst of developing cardiomyopathy and heart failure. Mm-hmm. I was blessed enough to hook up with some MPs online. Their group is called MP Foundations. Shout out to Michelle and Kiki. I'll be letting you know about this. I lectured twice on cholesterol lectures. And the nurses, the MPs, they loved it. So they inspired me to start this. It's a labor of love because we need to help each other out.
Definitely.
We don't get residencies. No one's going to say, well, how do you manage cholesterol? I'm telling you, it's not, oh, well, this is the pathophysiology. That's not my lecture style. I do case studies. I'm asking you questions and I'm telling you, case in point, I hate simvastatin. I tell
oh,
you,
me point, too.
We don't do that. Okay. We don't roll like that. Okay. Interacts with verapamil, interacts with amlodipine, highest cases of rhabdo. Mm-hmm. I'm giving you concrete data. I'm quoting things from ACC and giving you a trajectory of the strongest statins, your middle dose statins. Shout out to Livelo for being the most tolerated statin. I'm it's telling expensive. You, right. I'm oh, telling you stuff, the approach on how to approach a patient, what tools do you have in your toolkit, coupled with evidence-based practice. And I like to do it in a safe environment. I'm asking you questions. I'm going to present a case, but I'm going to ask you, so what do you want to do? The patient I mentioned earlier about with the shortness of breath ended up being an AFib. I put her in my interesting case studies to give you a more global view. Yes, it is geared to more to cardiology because I mean, obviously,
yeah.
But cardiology is important. And in primary care, you do manage lipids. And I have students all the time, well, their triglycerides are high. I tell them, don't worry about the triglycerides. Yeah. Treat your LDL first.
Mm-hmm.
So it's stuff like that, like I said, it's a labor of love. It's interactive. You get me. It's not a boring recording. You
know,
get to talk to me, ask me questions, and learn and grow and evolve. And I'm excited. We're launching June 11th. So check me out on Dr. GDMP on Instagram and Facebook. I'm around.
All right.
Cannot wait.
Well, thank you for hanging with us, Trinise. We are Anytime. Super excited.
Y'all are the celebrities. I
mean.
Hey, listeners. Are you a new grad nurse or nurse practitioner with less than 2 years' experience? Are you a nurse practitioner transitioning to a different specialty that requires primary care knowledge?
If so, we got a great resource for you.
Dr. G, the MP, is offering nurse mentorships, NP coaching, and public speaking courses.
If you're interested in improving your EKG or hypertension and lipid management knowledge, Dr. G, the MP's program is a great way to get started.
Join Dr. G, the MP, on June 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time when she launches her new Dr. G, the MP programs on drgthemp.com.
Enter promo code NPOWERED NPOWERED21. That's NPOWERED21, and receive a 10% discount on any course you purchase.
Now until July 1st. Get connected
with Dr. G the MP. Check out our IG and Facebook page. Deuces.
Thank you for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at empowered20@gmail.com.
That's NPOWERED20@gmail.com.
Please join us next time on Empowered.
See you next time.